We're delighted to be able to have the opportunity to visit with Parley Bear this afternoon on our Those Were the Days get together. Parley, you're a kind of a transplanted Chicagoan, aren't you?
Well, not really. I spent a lot of time in Chicago, but my original rooting was in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Salt Lake City.
Uh-huh. And then moved to the West Coast, and then I used to come back to Chicago. I did publicity with the Medina Shrine Circus there, and mm-hmm. made guest appearances back there for, oh my, over 20 years. So I knew an awful lot of Chicago people. Joe Slattery and Mal Blair. And,
oh, yes, sure.
Lee Phillip and...
The whole Chicago gang.
Irv Cupsinet,
that's
the whole
right.
gang,
oh,
yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure everyone would say hello to you.
Well, give them my regards
when you
see them.
I shall. Where did your... You started with the circus. Now, how did that come about?
Like the school teacher who wound up as a call girl. Someone said, how did you end up this way? And she said, just lucky. So I don't know. I started out way back in the dark ages in outdoor amusement business. And then I went to work for a radio station. Stock was in its last final kick, and I played some stock, and then World War II came along, and after the war my wife Ernestine Clark, who was a circus performer, I met her interviewing her.
Oh.
And she and I moved down to the coast. We will have been in Los Angeles about it was 37 years last February. And since then, I've pretty much evenly divided my time between pictures, radio, television, and the circus. I've spent parts of every season, except during the war, with one circus or another since 1936.
Mm-hmm. Mostly doing advance work, publicity work, things like that?
Publicity, ringmaster, performance director.
Mm-hmm. You did something with the circus on television not too many years ago, didn't you?
Well,
you
were
involved in something?
Yes, I worked with Bob Yerkes on the first Circus of the Stars.
Ah, that's it.
Uh-huh. That was on, and whenever I'm cast as a circus performer or ringmaster, they generally think I'm not the type, so I don't get the part.
Although it was only your job for many years.
Right. That's right.
Well, that's always
sure.
the way. I think it was Herb Vigran who was telling us that... he had a certain kind of... Sheldon Leonard, who said that he was so typecast as a gangster, tough guy, Damon Runyon type all the time, that sometimes that they would say, well, it's a Sheldon Leonard type. Get me a Sheldon Leonard type. And they said, well, Sheldon Leonard is available. No, we don't want him.
Oh, yes, we've all gone that. Certainly I'm a much lesser light than Sheldon. But and you know, he's such a marvelous all-around actor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great classic actor, and they did a lot of stuff on the stage, but he did so well in that thing, and he gained so much fame both on the screen and then for years, you know, he was on the Benny Show doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you get cast in it. I think in most everyone's minds, you're cast to a degree. In the old days of radio, I could almost tell the kind of part it was going to be by the director who hired me.
Mm-hmm.
Some saw me as a rural hay raker, and somebody else saw me as a booming second-rate politician. And it's good that people don't all think alike. If you're playing the, like the Indian said, everybody would want his squaw. But variety, I think, is kind of the springboard on which an actor works. And none of us, I think, likes to get typed unless stand-up comic or someone has become excessively successful. Like, you can't imagine Harry Langdon doing anything but what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Durante and this, that, and the other thing. But I think the average actor does not like to be too closely confined.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's more challenged, too, in a variety of roles. A major star on any of the areas, radio, TV, movies, they almost always end up playing themselves. But
that too is a rare ability.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was more of that, I think, in the 40s than there is today. Example: Jimmy Stewart almost always kind of played Jimmy Stewart. Yeah. He had different roles, but he was really, and we wanted him as Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, and amazingly enough, in whatever he played, even as Jimmy Stewart, he was believable.
Yes.
And acceptable. Mm-hmm. Look at Errol Flynn. Mm-hmm. He played all the great Western heroes of all time with the, what was the one, Dodge City?
Yeah.
He was the town cleaner up, Olivia de Havilland, as British as they make them, and I think Michael Curtiz directed it, so there was a triumph.
Yeah, a real variety there.
Yes.
Well, speaking of Dodge City, you spent a lot of time on radio in Dodge City, didn't you?
I sure did. 11 years, nearly.
11 years. You were Chester.
Chester.
On the Gunsmoke.
The first Chester.
Yeah.
Bill Conrad was Doc, mm-hmm. and Howard McNair. Bill Conrad was Dylan.
Dylan. Uh-huh.
And Howard McNair played Doc, and a fine actress by the name of Georgia Ellis played Kitty.
Now, this is a show for radio that came along more or less at the end at the beginning of the end of the radio days, and yet it lasted for all of those years.
Yes. I'm glad by that time we were recorded ahead, and we were all very grateful that we had enough shows recorded and enough shows in the can, so to speak, that we did not know when we were doing our last one. I don't think it would have been a very enjoyable day for us to go in there knowing that that this was it. I missed five out of about 530 because I was overseas making a picture called Young Lions, and we ran into bad weather, and so I missed. I was written out of five.
I was just going to ask, did they replace you or write you out?
They just wrote you out.
You weren't in on it.
I think 1 week I had mumps, and another week I was sent on an errand and got lost. I don't know.
Those were really fine programs. They were, I guess you could say, adult westerns for radio.
That's how they were billed, adult westerns. Mm-hmm. I think, as a lot of shows have done now, I think we entered areas that westerns, indeed that radio shows, had not entered before. There was a little of the psychological involved, there were instances where sometimes right did not triumph, mm-hmm. as in the real world. And the thing about Gunsmoke, it became a labor of love for all of us. I know I still have a big library of Western fact and fiction, mm-hmm. of that era. And John Meston, who's the chief writer on there, said, gosh, this is the hardest show to write because everybody knows, as far as dates and whatnot are concerned, everyone knows if I'm right. He said I have to be doubly careful, mm-hmm. on my research. But we were a pretty intact group there. We had the same director, the same assistant director, the same script girl, the same engineer, the same sound crew. The music was the same, and in addition to the four regulars, there probably were not more than 20 or 25 people, mm-hmm. that were used. It formed a pretty tight nucleus, stock company, as it were, for that. And the show, I think that if we had been given just an outline, I think that Bill and Howard and Georgia and I and some of the regulars, I think we could have ad-libbed a show.
Was that tight and that close?
We got to know each other's timing so well. Mm-hmm. And anticipate each other's thoughts. And I remember little things like, Dylan had told Chester to put some wood on the fire, and the sound of the logs going on there, and I went. He said, "Well, get out of the smoke."
Just as an ad lib,
huh? I said, "Green." Uh-huh. He said, "You should have got dry." And then we went on with whatever we were doing, and things like that.
You really got into it. Then.
That
you
gave us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction was there from the listening audience at this time? Because it was really a different kind of a Western.
Yes. It was, and we got it. We pulled a tremendous amount of mail, mm-hmm. and I would say 99% of it was favorable. Now, you know, Matt Dillon, as a character, the name was, I'm sure there have been Matt Dillons, even as there is a young Matt Dillon mm-hmm. on the screen today, but I'm sure that in years past there were many Matt Dillons, but none who figured in Dodge City or Points West. It was a name made up by John Meston. But we had a letter at one time from the Dodge City Chamber of Commerce asking if we could shed light as to what years Matt Dillon was there. They said, "We have ascertained that there was a Matt Dillon who was a marshal here at one time, but we don't know what years." Well, so far as our research was concerned, Matt Dillon was a fictitious character.
Yet a lot of the storyline was based on, or at least the setting was based on historical appropriateness.
Yes,
right?
Uh-huh. And John and other writers, E. Jack Newman and Kathleen Height, were great contributors. They worked in names that were famous or infamous, as the case might mm-hmm. be, that area, like the Earp boys and Clay Allison and... I think the very first one we did, Billy the Kid mm-hmm. worked into it. And that, I think, lent an air of reality and verisimilitude to the thing, removing it from the strictly fiction stigma, uh-huh. as it were.
There was so much, not so much, but there was a noticeable amount of inaction as compared to the Lone Ranger and Hopalong Cassidy and other Westerns that had preceded Gunsmoke on radio. There would be many scenes where it was just almost a quiet conversation going on between
introspective,
Matt
a lot more introspective
and yourself. Or
but you see, the sound kids on there, the sound men, were so dedicated to it, mm-hmm. too. If the shot was a 44, they recorded a 44 shot. Or if it were a 22 or a 38 or a shotgun, it wasn't just a bang, bang. Mm-hmm. They were extremely careful and extremely solicitous of exactly the right sound. And if we were in a riverbed, the horse's hoofs ran through sand. If it was grass, they thundered on a swishy sound of grass or gravel or whatever. Those kids worked hard. They devoted many, many hours outside of the pay load to making it successful. And Rex Corey, when we were using live music, his music was original, but he based it on themes and snatches of song that were popular mm-hmm. at that time.
It's interesting to note that, again, as I mentioned earlier, this came in as a new show near the end of the basic radio period. It started, I guess, about 1951 or 52, didn't it?
52. And there were a few sporadic ones, I think, in late 51, but the first show to go on as part of the series was in April
of 52.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think. Now, you had a sponsor in the beginning. I think you had L&M cigarettes.
They came in later. I think we had a sponsor. I think we had a sponsor on one show. We used to, in those days, we did it live, and they taped it. And then it was, we did it live Sunday night. And it was repeated on Saturday mornings, as I recall, by tape. And then when we started taping it, because Bill had to go away, he was working on a picture, and Norman McDonald had other assignments and that. So then we started, after about 2 or 3 years, we started taping two every other Saturday.
When you taped, you didn't tape it before an audience, though?
No.
No, at that. In the live show, was that an audience in the beginning?
No.
Never an audience. It's fascinating to me to know that you got good ratings in well into the 50s, middle 50s, late 50s with all of this stuff. And even at the end, when there were no sponsors to buy the whole show anymore because everybody was turning their attention to television, CBS continued to keep the program on, and you had a series of participating sponsors.
Yes.
They had the spot. They were
yes, we
spot
did.
Advertisers.
Well, after L&M, I think L&M went from us to the live to the TV show, didn't they?
I think they were on.
Yeah, was it? See, it was 3 years after we were on as on radio that it went to television.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a long time L&M sponsored both, and then I think General Foods took over,
mm-hmm.
or else it was reversed. General Foods did it first.
At any rate, you had some sponsorship on radio for this, which at
yes,
the time
we
when
did.
Other sponsors
and
were
at the
free.
Time we went off, we were the high, of course there weren't too many left, but we had the highest rating of any radio show on CBS when we went off the air.
You were Chester Proudfoot.
Mm-hmm.
On radio, yet they changed his name for TV, and I assume that's because of the limp that was given the character, right, on TV?
No, kind of an interesting thing, you know, how careful sometimes people are. They get almost paranoid about the idea of plagiarism. Bill and I used to, we played games with each other sometimes, and with the rest of the cast too. Bill would love to hang you up on a broken speech. You'd say, "Well, if I," and he would just let you hang there until you finished it. And Bill was, bless his heart, he was marvelous to break up, because he was like Edward Arnold when he broke up. The earth shook, you know, that magnificent voice and. But he left me hanging one day, and I said, "As sure as my name is Chester Wesley Proudfoot," and he said, "Chester Wesley Proudfoot, where did I come up?" I said, "Well, you see a broken speech, break in," and I won't say it. He named me originally on the first show. I was just Townsman, and Bill said, "He's got to have a name. I can't say, 'Hey, Townsman, come here a minute. I want to talk to you.'" So he named me Chester, as he named. He named him Dr. Charles Adams, because Howard played him as though he could anticipate the taste of blood a little bit and did weird things in the full of the moon. So he called him Dr. Charles Adams. That's how he got the name. And Chester, well, then that name stuck. Well, there was a man by the name of Hal Hudson, who was an executive at CBS. We were good friends. We used to argue a bit, but he, when it transferred to TV, they changed the name of Proudfoot to Good. And I met him in the hall one day, and I said, you really needn't have changed the name. I said, "Even if CBS doesn't trust me, I trust them." I said, I wouldn't. You can still use the name Proudfoot if you want to. I probably stole it from some. But that's how that happened. It was changed from He said, well, we felt that Prabhupada had an Indian named sound to it. I said, well, if Chester came from Oklahoma, maybe there was a little Indian blood in him. Who knows?
Well, they have vice presidents at the networks who have nothing to do but worry about little things
That's right.
I think.
Vice president of nitpicking.
Now, besides the creating the role of Chester on Gunsmoke, Parley Bear, you did a lot of other radio work over the years, haven't you?
Oh, my, yes. I was very, very lucky in radio. There was hardly a radio show on the dramatic show on the West Coast that I didn't get a crack at once in a while. Of course, Lux was one of the great loves of all of us, but Lux, Screen Directors Guild, and The Whistler, Escape, Suspense, First Nighter, those Websters.
You've worked with those Websters. You worked with Willard Waterman for a while on that.
Yes, and on he did a lot of First Nighters too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then he, of course, had replaced Hal Perry on the Gildersleeve show, and you worked with Hal after he left Gildersleeve.
Well, it's the other way around. Willard was the original great Gildersleeve, and then he left the show, and Hal became the great Gildersleeve, and then years later, Willard went back to doing Gildersleeve after Hal.
Oh, you mean Willard had a small part as Gildersleeve with the
originally,
McGee?
Before. But this goes way, way, way back.
Yeah.
But yes, and I was for two seasons with Hal Perry on a show called Honest Harold the Homemaker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were part of a select group of actors, I think, who appeared in virtually all of the CBS programs in the 1950s. CBS was the network that hung on the longest
just
to radio.
With dramatic shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Workshop and Escape and so many things like
yes,
that.
Yes, and then
Suspense.
You remember Armor Star Theater on Saturday mornings?
Mm-hmm.
And, I did The Mayor of the Town with Lionel Barrymore and did a lot of specials with him. Then Hallmark Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
We did a man by the name of Art Ronnie some years ago. I was doing a little piece. He's a PR man at Warner's now, but he was doing a little piece on me, and he said, you have done around 70 or 80 pictures, nearly as I could figure out, and you had done close to 500 television shows, and he said, when I got up to 5,000, I quit counting on radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine that that would be the case. You, I'm sure, like so many of the other actors out here, were doubling on some of the shows and were doing more than one show in a day.
Yes, you just say you hadn't really arrived until you had a conflict.
Did you find it easy to move into television after the as TV was coming in on the scene?
Yes. Yes, I did. I had the advantage of being stage trained,
mm-hmm.
and some of those who couldn't move over strictly radio had a little difficulty. But they were few and far between. No, we all made the transition pretty easily, with this exception. Very often, we were not playing the kind of parts on TV that we played on radio,
mm-hmm.
because we didn't. Look it.
You didn't look like
no.
You sounded.
No.
Yeah. And, of course, how did you sound? It was all up to the imagination of the person who was listening to you on the radio.
That's true. I think that radio is the ideal medium for a performer, because if 12 million people were listening, you were giving 12 million performances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad that it had to go, but it was a lot of fun while it lasted.
Well, you contributed a lot to it, and
thank you.
Appreciate all of that.
I hope I
work.
Did. We all tried. We were all, and there was as much glow and generating in radio as there was in anything else. In the days of live radio, every night was the first night, you know, mm-hmm. and shows like Hallmark Playhouse and Screen Directors Guild and Lux and all of that. You did those in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days of radio, like Dr. Christian and all that, we did two shows because you had to do one for the East and one for the mm-hmm. West Coast. Mm-hmm. So you gave a show generally anywhere between 4:30 and 6:30, and then you...
That would run in the East.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then you came back and did one anywhere from 7:30 to 9:30 or something.
Were they basically identical programs? Or did they ever make any changes from the West Coast to the East Coast, or
no,
vice versa?
No, the only changes that were made were inadvertent.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, the old, remember those old machines called Ditto machines?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Forerunner of the...
Mimeograph and
well,
the
they
Xerox.
Were kinda, yeah,
yeah,
like a Xerox.
Reproduction, yeah.
But it was blue, and it was a glistening piece of paper, and the printing came out blue. And I remember we had a snappy 5 or 10 seconds one night on Dr. Christian, and the electrician, just as we got started, inadvertently threw on a blue border, and all our pages went absolutely blank. The only one who was not aware of it was Gene Herschold, who used to sit at a table and had a table lamp.
Oh,
there. And he wondered what all the consternation was, but it was pretty lively there at the front microphones for a while until someone got over there and whacked the electrician and got some white borders back on. But those were the only changes uh-huh. that took place between the East Coast
some
and the
clubs,
West Coast.
Occasionally yeah. an actor didn't show up for the second show, I suppose. But
once in a great, great while, they wouldn't show up. And strangely enough, and I'm not putting the onus on anybody, but oftentimes they'd have a guest star, a movie mm-hmm. star, who did it and thought, that's it. And he wouldn't come back, and you'd see the directors like Fred MacKay or Bill Gay or these people who were using the movie stars were just on them like leeches, saying, now remember, you have to do this again. Yeah. When I remember Burt Lancaster on a Lux.
Mm-hmm.
Came back a little late, and the late Jeff Chandler mm-hmm. played the first half of the show as Burt Lancaster.
Oh, he had it. Oh,
yeah. Although those were moments that aged you, but they were fun.
They're special moments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of special moments in the career of Parley Bear. We're going to continue with this conversation in just a moment. Parley Bear, we were talking a little while ago about the Lux Radio Theater, and you must have played that show 100 times, if once, I'm sure.
Probably, yes.
Yeah, because your name always, as we listen to some of those old shows, your name always pops up in the cast
yes.
somewhere along the line, either as a first or second supporting player or somewhere down the line, because I guess they just used people
well,
all
they
over
would,
the place.
They would bring generally two stars or mm-hmm. three. And if they could get them to recreate their own parts, they would. But then they would cast the second leads and supporting players from radio cast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the real pros who knew what they were doing on radio. I suppose the stars had to have a little extra coaching sometimes.
Well, you see, Lux Radio Theater, unlike many shows, that was a 4-day rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have a... The first day would consist of readings and cuts and getting to know you type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, we didn't even get up on our feet the first day. And then the second day, we would get up and they'd start miking mm-hmm. and whatnot. And then the rehearsals generally were Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Monday.
So you had Sunday off, didn't mm-hmm. do anything. Was there someone from the production crew feverishly working on Sunday, tightening things up, or did it just had they
by that time it was pretty well timed. Uh-huh. The commercials were in, and mm-hmm. and we had already had two or three dress rehearsals with the orchestra, and the orchestra came in on Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and By Friday, unless there were real script difficulties, it had pretty well gelled and had settled.
Now, you did the Lux Always. A Lux Always was done before a large live audience, or at least it appeared to me to be a large audience. About how what size an audience did they have?
Do you know the Huntington-Hartford Theater in L.A.?
On Vine Street,
on
between
Vine Street.
Sunset and
Well, that's where it was done. And the seating capacity, I should judge, would have been about 800, between 800, 800 and 900.
That's a good size.
It's a good size theater. And depending upon the show, how many live sound effects, like gunshots or this, that, or the other, if it were a Western, would depend. But it was used a lot of velours and tormentors and teasers, and it was set up. It was elegantly costumed, the stage, with velours and velvets, hung at various angles so as to conduct and challenge channel sound. Sometimes the pieces of velour would be replaced with flats if they wanted an outdoors effect, and very often in the show, during the commercials, flats would be substituted for velours and or vice versa in order to create various outside or inside effects. The orchestra was at the rear, often baffled, with Celotex boards shutting it off that were mirrored with plastic set at an angle so that it didn't get too much boom. There was a booth on the side and a booth up in the what would be like the movie booth, you know, the projection booth.
Up in that section.
And chairs were in a row, depending upon the size of the cast, either a single or a double row, and two or three microphones used. Generally, each star had his or her own microphone. And then there were, as I say, depending upon the number of the cast, the either two or three more microphones were there.
If Humphrey Bogart were playing opposite Lauren Bacall on this, they would each be working from a separate microphone?
Yes.
Even through the love scenes and things like that?
Yes.
And then
but generally posted so they could see each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would they be very far apart? 4 feet, 6 feet?
Probably about 6 feet apart, so that one's mic did not pick up the other ones.
Oh, I see. And then as the supporting players or any of the actors who were, or actresses in the show were needed, they would just come up to whichever mic was designated to them, I assume.
You marked it on your script, or very often, too, if you had a very intimate scene with a star that you were, you know, supposed to be hiding in a ditch or waiting to rob a bank or something, then you would get on that microphone with that star
to create that kind of
entre nous bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where was the sound effects department at this time?
They were at one side or the other, generally to the left.
Generally to the left. And they would
as you face the stage.
Yeah, and so there would be anywhere from one, two, or three people, I suppose, doing sound.
Yes, depending upon what they had. And then, of course, they had their own set of microphones. It was and then a set of microphones for the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And then if this particular show had an awful lot of people in it for mob scenes and whatnot, there would be a mob scene microphone over to the other side. So the engineer had his hands full.
They really put it together so nicely.
Yes.
The audience at home listening could certainly visualize whatever the story was.
And
it's about the only time you ever realized that this was a theatrical production, because it was the Lux Radio Theater, was when there would be a ripple of response from the audience, the studio audience, and that would often come in a light romantic scene or whether it would be a funny line delivered or something.
Yes. Yeah. But most of the time, the audiences behaved themselves. If if something went wrong, they'd get a little unruly and titter and giggle when they shouldn't. But that was fortunately rare.
Yeah. Cecil B. DeMille and William Keighley were the hosts, really. They really weren't the producers of the Lux Theater.
They just they came in and just played a part.
Mm-hmm. Were the commercials done live on the stage, or were they done from another studio off the stage? John Milton Kennedy would be talking to a new starlet or something about how she used Lux soap.
They generally did those just a little off camera, off stage, so that any adjustments that needed to be done could be like rearranging the velours or rearranging the flats. Mm-hmm. And most of the stars had their pages stapled to thin pieces of cardboard so it wouldn't rattle. Well, that got to be a pretty good size hand.
So, well,
so
for an hour
after
show,
the first act was over, an assistant would take those and check to make sure that their other pages are in the right order and put them. They each had a little stand by their microphones.
Nice.
That because they weren't used to it, and they had long parts. Of course, we were used to holding our papers and changing our script so that it didn't rattle. If one rattled his script, he was in disgrace for days.
Is it true that they in some cases would just take the used page and drop it to the floor?
Some people did that, and I think that was done mainly in movies. That was a very disastrous thing to do.
I can imagine.
Because there was always the danger of walking on it. And then it sounded like you were walking down a snowy path. And in the case of the studios, the non-audience studios, where you had just four walls, so to speak, and the control booth, and it was generally very hard, very highly polished vinyl floor, or maybe they would put rugs under the microphone or the area where you were walking. But those papers, if they were thrown down, you could slip on them. Mm-hmm. It was a hazardous thing to just throw papers willy-nilly around. The accepted method was to just quietly slide it in back.
Put it in back of the other
back,
stack of pages.
Some people still did that. I know Jack Johnstone used to direct. He never went in the booth. He directed as they did 400 years ago. He'd put earphones on, had his own booth, and sat right, or stood right in the studio with you, which most of us found extremely annoying. He was a very affable man, but I said, gosh, your credit should read directed and conducted by, because he'd wave and point and whatnot, and he insisted on certain weird techniques that after a while you rebelled at, but if you wanted to work, you did it.
Which did you prefer doing, a live show or a non-audience show?
On radio?
On radio.
Oh, I didn't care. I liked doing them both. Mm-hmm. If it were a comedy show, I much preferred an audience.
I can't even think of a radio comedy show without an audience.
Oh, some of them.
Vic and Sade.
The daytime shows.
Yeah, some of those things,
but,
I suppose.
It would have just been terrible for, say, Burns and Allen or Benny or Skelton or any of those people to work without an audience.
Oh.
Because
they needed the audience reaction
for
their timing.
They needed that impetus,
sure
they did, for timing.
Now, you worked a little bit on radio with Ozzie and Harriet.
Yes, I did just a few shows before they went over to television.
But then they brought you with to TV, and you spent quite a few years with them.
7 years.
7 years. And you were one of Ozzie's neighbors.
Narby.
Narby, yeah.
Yeah.
Darby.
Uh-huh. I went back then. They switched the storyline to where it featured the kids more in their college activities and whatnot, but they called us Ozzie's Posse. We used to go back occasionally. Then I worked with Ozzy several times on other projects that he was directing, and when they did that series Ozzy's Girls, I did mm-hmm. the pilot on that and appeared several times on that. And
well, you were a familiar face then to the audience as well, so that
oh yeah
would be part of the yeah
Lyle Talbot, Frank Cady, mm-hmm. Gordon Jones before he passed away, and Billy McLean was a regular. Hal Smith, who later played Otis, the drunk on the Andy Griffith Show.
Oh, yes. Did you ever play the TV Gunsmoke?
Never.
You never did. They couldn't find a spot for you on the
yes.
On the TV.
Foolish pride, I wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it?
No, I didn't. We felt that we got kind of a dirty deal on there. We didn't know it was going to go TV until we read it in the trade papers.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't audition any of us. And Bill would have just been ideal for that. He was, as a matter of fact, to describe him and describe Wyatt Earp, you would use exactly the same adjectives. And so Bill finally wound up directing some, but he would never appear on it. And,
well, you say Bill Conrad would have been ideal for Wyatt Earp on you mean
I said
Matt Dillon?
Direct, he would have been ideal for Matt Dillon. I said, because he and Wyatt Earp, on whom Dillon was based,
uh-huh.
In those days, a tall man was 5'9 or 5'10.
Mm-hmm.
A 6-foot man was out of the ordinary. 100.
You mean back
years.
In the Western?
Yeah.
But weren't they really producing that for the audiences of the?
Oh, sure they were.
Of the
sure
60s,
they were. Sure.
You know?
Oh, sure. They didn't care how tall they were then. But mm-hmm. The only thing I think that they could have been a little more gentlemanly in their treatment of us. If they had said, "Would you care to audition? We don't think you're right, but." If you would you like to audition? Or maybe we would have been right, you know? We don't know.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you there. It's kind of tough after you've been doing this for so long, and then all of a sudden...
And it was a little irritating. They'd say, we'd write our ad-libs in, you know, and I used to find myself getting a little hot under the collar. The first 2 years, they were a half hour, you know, instead of an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'd hear some of my write-ins there, and I'd faunch a little bit, but it didn't do much.
And
good.
You mean that some of the TV shows were based on the radio scripts then?
Sure, word for word.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
They those half-hour ones.
Mm-hmm.
They did. They just cut them a little bit to accommodate the sign-on and the commercials. But they were, and we rewrote and wrote and ad-libbed and put in and. What not, and they were not above using some of our choices lines.
Well, that was the naturalness then of the show that you brought to it, you and Bill Conrad and the others, as you described earlier about the.
Well, I remember, and I get on him about it every now and again. That Dennis Weaver said we had nothing but the plain canvas upon which to draw. And I said, well, then you were drawing from the underside, or else you used just water brushes because the pictures were there, boy.
What are some of the other things you did on TV?
On TV?
In series. Or
well, I was on the Andy Griffith Show for mm-hmm. 3 years, and I did many Bewitcheds. I did Scads of the I Love Lucy Show. I did mm-hmm. Benny. Danny Thomas, Movies of the Week, Have Gun, Will Travel, The Rifleman,
mm-hmm.
Most recently Dukes of Hazzard, Trauma Center, Three's Company.
So you're still keeping right up with everybody on all of these things. Now, I know you just recently... came out of the hospital with a, was it a quadruple bypass?
No, five.
Five?
Five valves.
What is that, a quintuplet?
quintuple, I guess.
Quintuple?
Quintuple bypass, yeah.
And how do you feel?
I feel good.
You look wonderful.
I feel
you getting good. Along all right with
sure,
it?
Sure, sure. All I've got to do is have a call and I'll...
You're on the,
and I'll be
on the trail again.
That's right.
I have to go, Mr. Dillon.
That's right.
Now, you have a very distinctive voice that helped you out very well during the radio days, and I know that you can double and do variations on that voice for whatever character you need, but you have been playing a TV version of a, I guess almost, a, I guess you couldn't call it a Cookie Monster, but one of the elves in the, or the head elf, was it, in the Keebler commercial?
Yes, I've done Ernie Keebler the for 14 years.
That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Not near long enough. I just, as a matter of fact, I just made that. There's a new product coming out called Soft Batch Cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did some demo spots just before I went into the hospital, and we'll be making some more of those in another week or two. And I've been very lucky there too. I don't know how many I've done, but I've done it for 14 years.
Well, that's a nice little annuity right there, I would mm-hmm. say, isn't it? But
like we used to say with Gunsmoke, it was on. It allows one just that extra degree of haughtiness that's necessary in dealing with recalcitrant agents.
So what is coming up next for you then, outside of the Keebler commercials?
Well, I have a movie that I just completed called Chattanooga Choo Choo that's up for release. And I had another picture released a few months ago called Dr. Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And I did one that they're having some difficulty with called White Dog.
White Dog?
Uh-huh. And I'm going to do a picture called The Albos. And I had an interesting thing just about a year ago now. I was called to do you'd call it an experimental theater. It was a short.
Mm-hmm.
Louise Fletcher, who won the Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Robert Loggia, and Belafonte.
Sherry, the girl?
Sherry. Mm-hmm. Belafonte was in it. It's based on an old W. Somerset Maugham story, and played a number of years ago in a trilogy of W. Somerset Maugham. Short stories, three of them. This one was called The Colonel's Lady. They changed the title, and it's now called Overnight Sensation. They modernized it and rewrote it mm-hmm. and changed it. But I played in it, and it was up for an Academy Award for live short subjects, and mm-hmm. they had the filming on it. We don't know what's happened to it. We won't know until the 9th. But out of 90 some odd submitted, it wound up in the final three. That was a lot of fun to do. And I was John Bloom directed it and produced it. And I was very proud to be a part of that. It was very, very nice. Very nice indeed. Then I lost a picture with Bill Asher while I was in the hospital. But I worked for him a lot. He did nearly all of the Bewitched.
Oh, yes.
And Temperatures mm-hmm. Rising, which he did, but they had to go ahead with the production, so I lost a good part in that. But you lose one here and you pick one up there.
Well, I don't think your hospitalization slowed you down any. You seem to have just, you say, oh, doggone it, I was in here and I missed that part, but pick up again. You can be very proud of all of the things you've done. I think that you contributed an awful lot over the years with your talents to making the audiences, whether they're movie audiences or TV viewers or we have a special interest in the radio listeners of the times, you did an awful lot to entertain those people, and your talents are really very special. And I want to thank you for doing all that work.
Very kind of you. I feel that whatever I did, it was a privilege to do, and I'm lucky to have been a part of all this. God's been very good to me, in that he has allowed me to pursue the various facets of show business that I most love, including the circus, the stage, the screen, TV, radio. And it hasn't really, my poor father went to his grave wondering when I was going to settle down and get a job. But this has been fun. And Chuck, I'm grateful to you for inviting me here this afternoon. It's nice to say hello to people who remember us, and thank you very much for including me in your list. You got a lot of my old friends.
We've been talking to a lot of folks. Special one is Parley Baron. Thank you.
Well, thank you.